This seminar is what is Understanding Transplantation and a couple announcements. If you're looking for the emotional aspects of living with PKD for patients, that's currently going on in the Washington room. The Dialysis for Children session is in the Lincoln Roosevelt room. You're probably tired of hearing this, but please fill out your evaluations and hand those in the back of the room. And it is true, for us to continue to try and meet the needs of those who attend, we just need as much open and honest feedback as we can get. So we really do appreciate and encourage you to fill out the evaluation forms. If in case of an emergency, please contact the registration information desk. And as a final note about this session, one thing that we do want to point out when it comes to transplantation, that please remember that transplantation is a treatment to end-stage renal disease, but it's not a cure for PKD. And so with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. This is Dr. Fernando Cosio. He's professor of medicine, the Division of Nephrology and Hypertension at the Mayo Clinic. So I'd like you all to welcome Dr. Cosio.
Thank you. Thank you, the PKD Foundation, for inviting me. It is indeed an honor. I also want to thank you for being here and try to get information about all the options that you have for your disease. For us physicians to have you well informed is critically important. And perhaps in transplantation, that's one of those areas that we definitely need the patients to be very, very involved with their care. So I really do appreciate your effort. I would like to talk about transplantation, and again, what I will try to do is to walk you through where you may be now, or you will never be, all the way down to the post-transplant period. And there may be a lot of information that probably you are familiar with, but bear with me. I wanted to cover as much area as I could. So in summary, what I would like to answer is the following questions. Why should I get a transplant? That's a good question, isn't it? The second one is, when should I get a transplant? Can I get a transplant? Well, how can I get a transplant? And now I got a transplant, so what do I do? You know, what do I expect? So let me try to cover those. Okay? So, why should I get a transplant? Well, that goes to if the official title is Benefits of Kidney Transplantation, okay? But really the question that you want to answer is, why should I get a transplant? And the obvious thing that if you ask most patients that will answer is this one. You know, I don't want to be on dialysis. Dialysis will take too much of my life, too much time. Dialysis is a fantastic therapy, no doubt about it. It has maintained patients alive for many, many years. But it takes a lot of time. You know, the 3 hours, 4 hours, three times a week is just a lot of your life that will be occupied on that. Transplantation, of course, you are much more free. Most people report that after transplant, they feel better. That after dialysis, my pointer is kind of blinking in and out. They feel better and they have more energy. Indeed, you have much fewer restrictions on your diet and activity. You know, when you are on dialysis, you have to be careful on the fluid that you eat. You had the previous session about diet. Really, post-transplant, if the kidney is working well, aside from being careful not to gain weight, you really have no restrictions on what you can eat or drink. And from our point of view, our physicians and researchers, any kidney recipient will live longer if they receive a kidney transplant than if they remain on dialysis. It doesn't matter if you are 2 years old or you are 70 years old. You will live longer, and significantly longer, for any disease, polycystic kidney disease being a good example, diabetes, any disease, any age, any race, any sex, you will live much longer if you receive a kidney transplant. So, of course, we favor transplantation. Of course we favor transplantation, because that's really what we want to do. And transplantation is really the primary form of therapy for anybody with kidney disease of any type, any stage kidney disease of any type. The second question is, when should I get a transplant? And I wonder if I could get another pointer. Essentially what I did in this plot, on the x-axis, on the horizontal axis over there is years, and this is an idealized plot. Okay, I just made up some data in here. I confess. And here on the y-axis, you have your kidney function, okay? So just imagine yourself that right now you have 100% kidney function. That's the 100 that I'm trying to point out unsuccessfully. And for years, you have maintained your kidney function at 100%. Now, diseases such as polycystic kidney disease, the evolution of the disease is not a sudden change. You don't go from 100 to 10%, but it takes years for that evolution. And this is indeed a blessing in disguise. So as you see, and that's what I try to do here, from 100 to 0, it will take many years, and it's variable. In some patients go faster, in some patients go slower, some diseases go faster, some diseases go slower. But it's always a slow progression of the disease, and that's critically important to realize that, because that gives us time to think of a thing and to plan things, and that's critically important. Now, this dashed line down there is the start of dialysis. So most people need to go on dialysis when the function is about 10%. Because at that point, they feel so badly, and there are so many things that they are wrong with how you feel that essentially dialysis is, in most patients, inevitable. That figure varies, again, from patient to patient, but 10% is a good number to remember. Okay, we want to definitely stay away from that dashed line. We want to act much sooner than that. Now, if you were to receive a kidney from a diseased person, from a cadaveric, so-called cadaveric kidney or diseased donor kidney, you can officially receive such a kidney, when your function is about 20%. Okay, before that, by law, you cannot be listed to receive a kidney from a deceased donor. But once your function gets to about 20%, you can actually be placed on a list to wait for a kidney. Again, that's too late. For my taste, that's too late. As you will see, remember this space from here, from 20 to 10, this will come to haunt us later on. You know, it's about whatever it is in there, 5 years. Remember that figure, 5 years. We want to act much sooner than that. I will hope, and I'm sure you do, because you are well-informed individuals, that when your function gets to about 40% or thereabouts, by that point you really are listening to talks like this one that hopefully will inform you of what my options are. What are my options? Is it dialysis? Is it what form of dialysis? What form of transplant? So by then you really should be, it's not that you need a transplant, but you have a plan. And that's critically important, to really have a plan, because transplantation and dialysis actually, but transplantation in particular is complex. You know, and not you don't have control of all the variables in your hands. If you did, you could do it all in 1 year, but there are too many other players. So you need time to plan for this. I want you to think about your kidneys, and again, this is an audience, I don't need to say this, much sooner than that. There are many, many studies being done, and of course this is self-serving, because it's talking about kidney specialists like myself, but there are several studies being done saying that the sooner that the kidney specialist becomes involved on patients with kidney disease, the better they are. When your kidney devolves or involves, this pointer, sorry about this, when your kidney loses function, it's not only that your kidney is losing function, but there are many other changes happening in your body. It's not only the kidney, but as you see later on, your heart will suffer from this. Many other things will suffer or could suffer from that. So definitely to involve a kidney specialist that is very familiar with all the changes that happen in the body, from your bones to your heart to your skin, throughout all this time is important. So that gives you a flavor of when. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's when you measure the kidney function, there are two ways to do it. One is to do a blood test, which is a serum creatinine, and you probably heard that. That's a crude test because essentially there is somewhat of a relationship that when your creatinine is 1, your function is about 100%. When your creatinine goes to 2, that means that you lost half of your function, so you are 50%. When the creatinine goes to 4, that means that you lost another half of that, so you are down to 25%. But that's a rough estimate. The best way to measure the kidney function is either to collect a 24-hour urine, this wonderful test, you know, that you carry the jug for 24 hours, collecting your urine, and that will give you not only... fantastic. Thank you. And that will give you a much better approximation of what your percent function of the kidney is. There are all the sophisticated tests to do that. So that's the 24-hour urine. One thing that, since you asked the question, in most doctor offices, including mine, on a routine basis when you go visit, you get their creatinine. Notice the change that I described to you. When you go from 1 to 2, that means that you lost half of your kidneys. Half. From 1 to 2. So when you go from 1 to 1.5, gee, that's a big change. I mean, it doesn't seem like a big change, but that's a big change in percent function. So be aware. If somebody tells you, oh, your creatinine is 1.8, it's not too bad. Forget it. I lost half of my kidneys already. You know? So, and that's the problem with the creatinine that, no, you didn't. But that's the problem with the creatinine that is, it really hides a lot under it, you know, because of the relation to function. So you definitely want your function measured from time to time. Let's see where we are. That those numbers, 1, 2, and so on, it depends a lot on how big we are. You know, for a baby, a creatinine of 1 is outrageously high. For a football player, they will never have a creatinine of 1. You know, so it's quite variable. You have to individualize to you what is my creatinine to start with. All right. So some points to emphasize. First of all, there is that all thought that you needed to be on dialysis before you get a kidney transplant, forget it. Not most of our transplants, about 40% of our transplants get a transplant and they never saw a dialysis unit. That is being considered the goal to achieve. You don't need to be on dialysis before you get a transplant. If you don't have a living donor, again, I'm repeating some points I made in the previous slide. If you don't have a living donor, you can be placed on a waiting list for a deceased donor kidney or a cadaveric donor kidney when your function is about 20%. But if you have a living donor, you theoretically can get a kidney before that time, and that depends on many variables, you know, how you feel about it. With the donor kidney, you can schedule it, you know, depending on how you feel. So even if your function is 20%, you are feeling fine, there's no rush. We can do it, you know, when the function is 18%, whenever we and the doctor and you feel that it's necessary to do it. But you can do it before 20% if you feel lousy. So can I get a transplant? Well, that's a good question. The transplant is a surgery, so if we think about it in the simplest of terms, you should be able to tolerate a surgical procedure. And that goes mainly to heart issues. You know, we definitely want to make sure that your heart is in good condition, you know, before you have surgery, before you do any kind of stress such as that. But in addition, when we consider somebody for a transplant, we have to consider many other issues. And the point in here is that we want to address as many of the nagging problems that we have been ignoring for quite a while before the transplant. You don't want to deal with those things after you have a transplant. So if you have tooth problems, for example, we don't want to deal with those after the transplant. Let's take care of those before the transplant. If there are infections that they need to take care of, for sure, they need to be cured before that. If there is a history of cancer, we want to make sure that the cancer is completely gone, that there has been a period of time that the cancer is truly gone before we do the transplant, and many other things that we check before the transplant. And those are not contraindications for transplantation, but those are important things to take care of before the transplant, the heart being the main thing. Of course, related to can I get a transplant, who is going to pay for the transplant, of course. You know, transplantation is an expensive procedure. The procedure itself and the follow-up. So, and again, you have heard this and for much better informed people than myself, but just be aware that there is, of course, a federal program called the Renal Medicare. You are eligible, regardless of age, at the time that you get a transplant or 3 months after you start dialysis. It will cover the cost of all the donor workup, so the donor will not have to pay for any of the tests that he or she will have to do. It will cover 80% of the cost of the transplant, the surgical procedure and the admission for the transplant. It will cover 80% of the medications that you need to take for the transplant. I refer to them in here as anti-rejection medications for 36 months, so for 3 years after the transplant. Okay. So how can I get a transplant? And of course, the question bears down to the recipient, to the donor. And again, that's one of those areas that you are very familiar, but of course you know that there are two types of donors, the deceased donor. Somebody dies and has signed the card, they want to donate the kidney to or any other organ to anybody. And there is a waiting time, and remember those 5 years? The average waiting time for those kidneys will be 3 to 6 years. Remember, you didn't have those 3 to 6 years at that point. Or a living donor kidney, and the living donor kidney can come from somebody that is blood relative to you, or it can be from somebody that is totally unrelated to you. It doesn't matter if it is your wife, that blood, regarding blood type, is or blood relative, she is not a blood relative. But it can be a friend, or it can be anybody else. I will work more on that. So let me bear down on this issue of selecting the donor. And there are essentially 4 points that we need to cover on these ones, and I will go through those so you understand the process that goes through our mind when we go through the transplant. First of all, the recipient, you, potentially you, has to decide. We doctors obviously don't decide for you. We advise you of what, you know, your choices are, but clearly you are the one talking with your friends, relatives about the type of transplant, and you need to make the decision. Our job is to advise you on that, or whether I get a living donor kidney or I get a deceased donor kidney. If volunteers in your family or friendships or whoever wants to donate a kidney, of course, then it becomes critically important, this issue. You know, is this living donor, can he, she give you a kidney? You know, from her, his health point of view. If we have a donor or whatever type, we definitely want to match that donor. It's kind of like getting a big, thick blood transfusion. We definitely want to get a blood type that is matching in between the donor and the recipient. And then there's the cross match that I will explain a little bit more. The living donor versus deceased donor, the equation, or the main components of the equation are the following. If you look at the living donor, the big advantage is mainly for the recipient, for the person that is going to receive the kidney. That's who is going to benefit the most from the living donor. There is no wait. Once you identify a living donor workup is completed. It can be scheduled at somebody's convenience. There is no wait. Theoretically, it can be done in 2 weeks. You know, from the time that you need a transplant to the time that you get the transplant, it can be done very quickly if everything lines up appropriately. The thing that we physicians like very much, and of course you patients like very much, is that this is a better kidney. The function is better of this kidney. It lasts much longer, and you will see the difference later on. It will last much longer than a deceased donor kidney. So this transplant, this type of transplant, lasts much longer for you. Particularly important if you are in the young, whatever that is, group category. The con of that is the risk for the donor. That's what we are concerned as physicians. That's what we are concerned as patients. We don't want to put anybody at risk. The donor is usually not concerned about this, you know. I mean, of course they are concerned, but the donor obviously has already volunteered. They are willing to take a risk, but that is a great concern. And indeed, many recipients, they don't want to. They are very reluctant to ask their kids, you know, for donation or something like that. That goes, actually, let me go back to the pros. I didn't list in here any advantages for the donor, and that's really not correct. But it's hard to quantitate. In many cases, the donor, the emotional advantage for the donor is enormous. The emotional rewards for the donors. It's very hard to quantitate in here as such, but clearly the donor gets an enormous boost of self-esteem by donating a kidney. The pros for the deceased donor kidney is, of course, you don't have to ask anybody. You know, you don't have to worry about anybody. You know, you just wait. It's quite successful. They are superb, these donor kidneys. And of course, for many years, that's all we did, or essentially all we did. But it's not quite as good as the living donor kidney. The big disadvantage, the waiting time. Again, remember those 5 years. And the kidney quality. Those are usually very high quality of kidneys, but not quite as good as the living donor kidney. The waiting time is of course a huge issue in the world, in the United States in particular. This is data from the United States, and I grab a slide from 2000, but it doesn't matter. If it was a slide from 2004, you will be the same type of trend. Those are years, 1989 to 1999, and those are numbers of patients. And in red, you have the numbers of individuals that they are waiting for a transplant in the United States. And you have seen this plot before. That figure has increased, and now I believe we are approximately 52,000 waiting for a kidney. This is the number of transplants that have been done from a cadaveric donor or a deceased donor, some slides say deceased donor kidneys. As you see, this is never going to cover the need. We are never going to have, it has been calculated that even if we had absolutely every single donor, potential donor, anybody in the United States who may die, even if we somehow use those kidneys for transplantation, we'll still not have enough kidneys. So it's not, we need to figure out what to do with that. And of course, this has been on the works for a long period of time. And this is an example of one program that happens to be my program, for obvious reasons. But really, any program can give you the same type of information, which is the gap. You know, we have all these patients in need. We need to help them somehow. So essentially what this shows is years up to last year, and these percent is numbers of kidney transplants. As you see, the yellow is the cadaveric donor kidneys, you know, the kidneys done from a cadaveric donor. So if you look at those bars, they really didn't change very much. They increased a little bit in here, you know, 1998, and clearly if you look at all these bars, in general, they are higher than they were in there, but it really didn't change very much. So the reason why we are doing now 250 transplants instead of doing 75 transplants is because the majority of them, you know, are done from living donors. We just cannot increase, if we are going to do 250 kidneys, we just simply do not have 250 kidneys to give. So all the growth, and as I said, this happens to be the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, but this can be any transplant program in the United States and actually in the world. The growth on the transplants, on the number of transplants that has been done in the world is really at the expense of living donation, living-related or living-unrelated donation. The second point, if you remember, about selecting the donor is the blood type. And I wanted to spend a second here, and I know you are familiar, we are all familiar with the blood types, but that actually will have consequences, understanding how the body reacts and how the immune system recognizes self versus non-self is important for this and the next slide. So. Now, when we know, we look at the person next to you and we all look different. We have characteristics, facial characteristics, body characteristics, they are different. Well, if I was going to take cells from you and cells from you, I also could tell that they are completely different. The cells, if you want, they have a different face for each one of us, a different characteristic of each, if you want the technical term, a different phenotype. You have a big word. In regards to the blood type, that's the simplest facial characteristics that we know for a long, long, long period of time. We know that we can mix blood from A and B, and sometimes they match together and sometimes they dissolve each other. Well, clearly there are different characteristics, so that has been known for a long, long time. So as long as the blood type, the red blood cells in your bloodstream, they have two labels, so this type of label, the blood type label, A and a B. Those are your choices. You can be an A or you can be an B. Now, the way this works and the reason why we are like that is because the cells are continually kissing each other. They are looking at each other continuously in my own body. I mean, my blood cells are going to my kidney and checking, is this his kidney, my kidney, whose kidney is this? You know, so they're continually checking, you know, are you an A or are you a B? Now, so that's how we recognize each other. I'm talking about myself, okay? I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about myself. Well, if I find something that is not mine, of course, then I have to do something about it. And to do something about it, I have some proteins in my blood that I call in here anti-labels. The official name is antibodies. That will recognize, you know, whether, you know, it will do something about something that is foreign to me. Now, in this system, again, it's a good example because it's a very, very simple example of one type of recognition. So you can be a blood type A, i.e. all your cells have a little A floating around. It doesn't matter where they are. They can be on the brain, they can be on the eye, they can be on the blood, they can be on the kidney. They have a little A label. So when they collide each other, they say, okay, this is an A, this is an A, this is an A. Boring life. But in any case. But if they find something that is not an A, then they have a bullet. I have a bullet that is an anti-B. So if I find something that doesn't match, not only I can tell this is not mine, but I can kill it. Okay? This is the bullet, the anti-B. So, forget about transfusion. I mean, this is the same for transplantation. So if I'm a group A, I want a kidney that looks like an A so I can fool my immune system. I definitely don't want a B because I will kill it. Well, if I'm a B, I do the opposite. I kill A's, you know, effectively. So I want to give a kidney that is a B. All right? Now, you have a few individuals in this room, about 10%, 15%. They are lucky enough to have both, an A and a B. Well, those A's and B's, obviously, they cannot kill A nor kill B because they will kill themselves. You know, so they don't have bullets. Those are easy. Those are easy to transplant and to give transfusion because they can get blood from A or a kidney from A, a kidney from B or blood from B, anything. Or from an AB. I mean, they are the common acceptors. And, of course, they are the generous people like myself, that they are a zero. And that's a variant that we don't know why this variant appears in the human system, but it's actually the most common variant that we don't have any antigens in the surface of our blood. We don't have neither A nor B. We have the absence of antigens. And I guess that's good enough for me to recognize myself, or at least I hope so. But still, I don't want A or B because I don't have any of those. So I have anti-A, anti-B. So I can donate to anybody, really, because I don't have any antigens. You know, so you don't care. You cannot kill me. But I can get only from zero. Okay? So this, I saw your arm. One second. So this that applies for blood transfusion, and of course we know for a long, long, long period of time, is directly applicable to transplantation. Yes, ma'am?
Rh
is irrelevant for transplantation. I don't care if I get a positive or a negative. My immune system just doesn't care. You know, it's important for transfusion in some cases. It's important for pregnancy, of course, and for some other reasons. But for transplantation, I really don't care. Those are the big ones. My immune system doesn't care. I do care, but my immune system doesn't care. Okay. Now, there are very nifty technologies these days that answer these questions. Can I get around the blood type? You have only one donor. And you are an A, and your donor is, the only potential donor is a B. Can I do something about it? And of course, yes. The answer is yes. Blood groups are definitely an important barrier for transplantation, but it's not an absolute one. And there are some programs like ours, for example, that we can do transplantations against a group. So we can fool your immune system and give you a B and make it look like an A, or make you think that it's an A. It's definitely possible. It's an option. Particularly if your titer of anti-B, in the example that I just did, is not very high. And it's quite variable. I mean, some of us, it seems like we are very acceptable of many other people. Some other people are really resistant to other people. So depending on what your titer is of these antibodies, you can get it or not get it. But even if the titer is positive, which is, of course is positive on everybody, we still can fool the immune system some degree. The first choice for a transplant definitely should be a blood group compatible, because that makes the preparation for the blood group incompatible and necessary. So it's cheaper, it's more convenient. But if you have no other options, we'll still work it out. Okay, so we work into the living and the deceased donor kidney check mark. We discussed that. We talk about the blood type, and we talk about the cross match. And the cross match is a critically important issue. I mentioned to you that our cells have faces, and I gave you an example of the nose, okay, the blood group. You can be an A or a B, but clearly there are many other features that we have externally, phenotype, remember this call, that our cells have. So all our cells have a whole array of features in there that everything needs to match. So when my cells are bumping into my own cells, they recognize themselves by many, many characteristics. The same that we do to the guy next door. And theoretically,
theoretically, I could have an antibody against, you know, this person sitting in you, for example, USA. I may have an antibody against you, although I never met you before. You know, sorry, but it's possible. Or you can have it against me. Okay, if you prefer that example, that's take that example. How can that happen? I mean, I never saw this lady before, or she never saw me before, so how can that happen? Well, actually, there are many circumstances. Many times we don't know how it can happen. Sometimes it can happen because I received a kidney in the past that had some antigens that were shared with you. I mean, there's not an unlimited amount or number of antigens. We have, you know, several thousands of antigens distributed into the population, so some of the antigens may be from the old kidney that I received, and from you also, and you know, we kind of cross match, and I learn how to recognize you. Other ways to do it, if you receive blood transfusions, of course, every single time you receive blood transfusions, you get cells that they look funny to you. They are not your own. Or during pregnancy. And females, of course, recognize the fetus, recognize the baby. You cannot kill the baby, you know, because you had the placenta, you had the barrier. Except for the RH circumstance that you mentioned before, but you can get immunized, you know, against your baby. So those are mechanisms. These antibodies definitely are very powerful, even more powerful than blood group antibodies, and can destroy the transplant. So we have to be extremely careful with those antibodies. So before every transplant, living donors, cadaveric donors, we every month we check you. For it, because these antibodies can come out of the blue, particularly if patients that they are on dialysis that receive blood transfusions, we are always very nervous, because we may have a perfect transplant lineup, and you receive 5 units of blood for one reason or another, and suddenly you have antibodies against the donor. So we check every month for patients, and a negative result is good. If you don't have antibodies, this is perfect. This is the way we like it. Against a particular donor. Can we get around the positive cross match? Absolutely, yes. Sure. Tough, but we can do it. In persons with low titer, again, the titer of those antibodies against the donor, it is possible to get around this problem in some centers. The early results are very encouraging on how we are doing it. There are very few centers doing this type of transplantation. It's complex, it's expensive. But again, in conditions that you just cannot transplant the person, that they are stuck on dialysis with severe problems, you can work around that. We don't know. This type of transplantation has been done really for the last 3-4 years. So we don't know what will happen 20 years from now. We just don't know. But it's very encouraging. The results are almost as good as for the other ones, although, again, it's more complex. Okay, so let me go through the checklist in here of the thing that we cover. I need and I want a transplant. I am healthy enough to receive the surgery. My heart is, you know, good. I don't have any infection. My teeth are perfect. I selected a donor, and the donor is healthy and willing to donate a kidney. So, okay, we are getting good. The blood group is a match, or at least we have a plan if it is not a match. I do not have an antibody against the donor, so this is perfect. So I'm ready to go. Okay, as you see, I mean, I'm going through this overly very quickly. This is a complex system, and that's the reason why I go back to the slide that you were referring to of the sliding slope. You know, we need time, you know, to cover all these things. They can be done in a hurry, but not very efficiently. It takes time, you know, to plan for all this. So, you know, we physicians and patients need to think about this in advance and plan for it. This is a slide I put in here as an anatomy lesson, but mainly is to show you this slide because it's really cool. You will see in 1 second. You will see in 1 second. The picture is nice, but the movie behind it is even better. In any case, these are your kidneys. No, those are not your kidneys. This is somebody's kidneys. A right and a left. This is the right and this is the left. So you're looking at this person from the front. I painted some ribs over there just to orient you, and you know where your kidneys are. So that doesn't tell you anything. And those are the hips, or the level of the hip, more or less. So this is the aorta. The heart will be up in here someplace. So there's the artery. You have the renal artery going to the right. And you see the variation that is very important to know on the donor. This donor, just to drive the surgeon crazy, has a left artery over there. But look at that. There's another little artery over there. You know, there's a squiggle coming over there. And we are all quite different. Some people have one artery, some people have two, some people have three, some people have four, just mainly to drive the surgeons crazy. But there's really no, we are just made different. Once you get towards the legs, you're split in half to the right and to the leg and to the left. And that's where you are. This technology, that is computer CT, actually, that's, isn't that cool? Isn't that fantastic? Yeah. But essentially, that's how we work out the donors these days, you know, at least in our institution, because with one shot, with a little teeny tiny amount of contrast, you know, you can give one shot in the vein and you can get all these pictures of the kidney. So you can look at the right kidney, you can look at the left kidney from the front, from the back, from the top, you can tip it back and forth. I mean, it's amazing, the technology. But of course, it's critically important, as I mentioned to you before, you know, like, for example, the squiggly artery that was going to the left is very, very important to know, you know, are there one artery or not? I mean, the surgeon needs to know that. So, okay, that was my picture. All right, so now let's do a transplant, you and I, and tell you, and again, this is on. So that's the same picture. I added the bladder in there, the urinary bladder, which usually will be collapsed. If in some individuals with polycystic kidney disease, of course, you have to account that these kidneys actually can go all the way down here, as you know very well, and I will address that issue of space. In the transplant itself, we usually do not take the native kidneys, but rather the surgeons do an incision right there in the lower part of your belly. And they put a kidney right there, you know, in fact, bumping into the bladder. Some people complain about that after the transplant. It's kind of like being pregnant with a kidney. So the kidney, essentially, you connect it to the artery and to the vein right there. I don't know if with the lights you can see it, but I think you can see it. If not, we can try to dim the lights. And then the ureter, the draining tube from the kidney, you know, is connected to the bladder right there. So as you see, really, we didn't go to the back, which is where the kidneys are, of course, in your back. We didn't touch the kidneys. In general, we don't have to do that. We just put the kidney over there. It's quite effective. It's much easier for the surgeon, i.e. for the patient, is much easier to do it, and it's quite successful. Essentially, 99.99% of the transplants are done this way, either on the right or the left kidney. It really doesn't matter very much. So what will happen during and immediately after the kidney transplant? Well, the surgery, in most people, take about 3-4 hours. It depends of your size. And you remember that, at least for a living donor, the surgery is being done for both the kidney, the donor, and the recipient. So it's complicated. All the surgeries need to be coordinated. When the kidney comes from the donor, we want to make sure that the recipient is open and there is a hole in there to put the kidney. So, I mean, it loses a lot of coordination. Two operating rooms are next to each other. You know, there are no obstacles in between with the kidney. I mean, it's a lot of, it's a fascinating surgery, actually. Now, this is an important point. To the chagrin of the surgeon, the transplant kidney usually starts making urine right away before it is connected to the bladder. And this is a thrill, I tell you. Yeah, you may think that it's not, but it is. It is. Because we connect the artery first, then we connect the vein, and we leave the ureter, the draining tube of the kidney, open. So if that kidney, in the moment that it sees blood, it starts, you know. This is great. This is fantastic. It means that kidney is a great kidney. And a good kidney should do exactly that. You know, immediately. As soon as it gets some perfusion, it will start making urine. It's a little bit of a challenge for the surgeon, but this is, I tell you, we all yell and scream in the OR when we are there. It doesn't matter how many I have seen. I'm not a surgeon, but that is still a thrill. The hospitalization is usually 4 to 5 days. We average 4.5 days in our program for these kidneys. This, of course, I mean, we are so used, 4 days. I say 4 days and nobody gasps. This is amazing. You know, this used to be, of course, 2 weeks, a month. I mean, this is unbelievable how things have changed over a period of time. Now, there are some specific issues on polycystic kidney disease, and of course the issue is a space issue, is a size issue. If my kidneys are too large, really one of the diseases that we worry about is polycystic kidney disease. Will there be enough room for the kidney? And the answer to that is almost always yes, there is room. At least we think so. You may not think so, but we do think so. Because you don't sometimes, because sometimes it's uncomfortable. I mean, when you have two large polycystic kidneys, and in addition we added another kidney down there, it can be very uncomfortable. I mean, indeed in some patients, the space issue is a big problem. That confronts us with all of us in here in this room, with the question of how do we do it? Well, we can take the kidneys out, the polycystic kidneys out before the transplant, but of course that means that you have to go on dialysis. You know, if you don't have any kidneys, you have to go on dialysis for a period of time, probably for weeks, for a couple of months, before we can do a transplant. And of course, nobody wants to do that. Sometimes you have to do it, sometimes you compromise and you take one kidney out to see if, but that's the option in there. Or the second option, which we like better, is to leave the kidneys alone and put the new transplant, make you healthier with the new transplant, normalize your kidney function, your blood pressure, your volume, your symptoms. You feel stronger. And then at that point, if there's still an issue, take those kidneys out, the old kidneys out. And this can be done these days laparoscopically. It's amazing how the surgeon can squeeze those big, huge kidneys through an incision that is yet big. They can take those kidneys out. And I don't know how they do it. Don't ask me. But they do it. So we prefer that option. But again, you have to work with every person with polycystic kidneys. You have to take pictures of the kidneys and study the space distribution in the belly. It depends on your size, too, of course. If you are very short and you have polycystic kidney disease, maybe much less space. Okay, I got my transplant. Now what do I worry about? And of course, worry about is the problem with transplantation. You always had to worry about, or at least I always had to worry about. As a transplant physician, I always had to worry about the transplant patients. And I always worry about two general issues whenever I see an individual in my clinic. More and more time I spend with general health issues. And intentionally, I put the transplant kidney as number two, because general health issues are critically important. For kidney recipients, they tend to have more problems than the general population with their hearts, cancer, infections, many other issues. And clearly, we need a healthy body to support this transplant kidney. It doesn't do us any good to have a great kidney and not a very good body. We need both. This is a big issue. This is a big issue with anybody with kidney disease. This is a much bigger issue in somebody on dialysis without kidneys. So I will elaborate on that a little bit. In regards to the transplant kidney, we always worry about that word, famous word, rejection. We worry about the original kidney disease coming back into the kidney. And, of course, polycystic kidney disease doesn't do that. But I include that in there. And there are other threats. So let me consider some of these general health issues. And the heart really deserves the big label in there. Because people that have kidney disease before the transplant or after the transplant, so the kidney disease itself somehow affects our heart badly. And transplant medications unfortunately worsen the risk for transplantation. Dialysis worsening is even much worse than heart medications. But it's probably a multiple factors, multiple variables. Blood pressure is an issue. It's frequently high after the transplant. It's frequently high before the transplant. High cholesterol. Again, before, but particularly after the transplant. Diabetes can develop after the transplant, of course, before the transplant. Weight gain is a significant issue. All these issues that they are common for the general public are very important for the transplant patient. Taking care of your heart is really a key part of my occupation, but it should be mainly part of your occupation, too. Of course, infections and cancer are always in the back of our mind on a transplant patient. The reason is the transplant medications, I call them in some other slides anti-rejection medications or immunosuppressants in other slides. They stop the immune system from rejecting a transplant, but unfortunately these medications are not very smart. So they stop my immune system from stopping anything, stopping anything that is foreign to me. So if you are on those medications, you don't stop infections very well, in part because you don't recognize them, in part because you don't react to them well. And the same thing for cancer cells. Cancer cells are not my cells. I'm killing my cancer cells all the time. And that's the reason why I don't get cancer. You are doing the same thing. Cancer cells are foreign, strange, weird cells. And that's part of the immune system, to keep us clean, cancer cells. When you are taking medications and immunosuppressants, you don't do that as efficiently as you are supposed to do. Now, in regards to the kidney, and again, I will open it for questions if you have more questions. I realize that I'm going quickly on this and covering a huge topic. But in regards to the kidney, we worry certainly of very early problems and always problems, and I will go into this in more detail in 1 second. But first of all, if you get a kidney from a living donor, there is an about a 2% chance, at least in our program, a 2% chance that the kidney will not work right away. That goes to, we usually call it a lazy kidney. And that goes to interesting discussion between usually husband and wives, you know. you gave me a lazy kidney. But, I mean, it's disappointing. You know, you go to the OR, you are waiting for that kidney to work right away, and sometimes it just doesn't. And there are multiple reasons to do that. This actually can happen up to 40-50% in some programs in some countries when you get a cadaveric kidney, because that kidney has gone through a lot. You know, to go from one person who dies, you know, to go to the cooler, to go to you, it may take, you know, 2-3 days to get to you. So that kidney really has gone through a lot. It's not terribly uncommon, more than what we like, that cadaveric kidneys don't work right away. They will, eventually, most of them they will, but it's certainly very disappointing. Surgical complications, I will cover in one slide, and those surgical complications, I'll take you back to my picture, I won't move it this time, are really related to the connections that the surgeons have to do. And the surgeons had to do microsurgery to connect this artery to the artery, the vein to the vein, and the ureter to the ureter. And, you know, whenever you do the surgeries, occasionally, rarely, but it happens. We are always nervous about those connections in the first few days. So if that kidney doesn't behave like it should behave, we are always concerned about those connections and make sure that they didn't fall apart. Rare, but certainly can happen. Rejection, of course, is a term that you all know, we all hate. Essentially, if the immune system of the recipient, the person that receives the kidney, escapes the immunosuppressive drugs or the anti-rejection drugs, it can cause inflammation of the kidney or acute rejection. And it has the term rejection, but just imagine it's the same that if you are in Minnesota now and you get bitten by a mosquito, you are rejecting the mosquito bite, you know, and you see how your arm feels and how good it looks. You know, it's nice and it's swollen and it's tender and it's red. The kidney feels the same way. It's the way the immune system rejects something that is not mine. It doesn't matter if it is something from a mosquito or it is a transplant kidney. The body has, at the end, it has a very different ways to recognize things, but at the end, the killing system, the killing mechanism is very common for all these processes. So this is the immune system recognizing, escaping my medications and recognizing the kidney is not mine. I had to get rid of it. Now, this figure, 15-20%, may seem very high. 10 years ago, this figure was 40-60%. So the advances on that has been astounding. And that has made a huge difference, beneficial difference, for the patients, and I assure you, for us, on taking care of those rejections. Some programs report routinely less than 10%. It's quite variable, but we are in those, what we call ridiculous numbers, fantastic numbers. They tend to occur very early after the transplant. The immune system is particularly alert during the first month and during the first, so 90% of the rejections occur during the first 3 months after the transplant. After that, you know, things kind of adapt to each other, the immune system to the kidney, and things are cooler. But those first 3 months, the first few weeks, the first few months, month is really hot period. Essentially, if you have rejection, you require more medications. If you have rejection, that doesn't mean that you lose the kidney. As a matter of fact, we barely, rarely lose any kidney from rejection. It means there is additional treatment that you had to do, you know, to cool down the immune system. So just because you have rejection, 15-20%, that doesn't mean that we lose 15-20% of the kidneys. It means that you had to treat, you know, beyond the call of duty. Okay? Now, because rejection is such a big issue, it is a big threat to the kidney. We really want to monitor that you for rejection, you the recipient for rejection. And we don't have very good tests. None of the transplant organs have very good tests for rejection. On the kidney, we are actually more fortunate than in the heart. In the heart, there is no blood test to tell you of rejection. In the kidney, at least, we have a creatinine, going back to that test. They at least give you an idea although we are not 100% comfortable with that, at least we can do a blood test, in our case, creatinine, that we can measure, and we can measure kidney function. And in the kidney function, suddenly changes. It goes from the 1 to the 1.5, the sample that we used before, and there's no other reason for that. We really are nervous about rejection then. Now, some programs like my own, we really want better than that. And the blood test, sometimes it makes us nervous because it may miss some rejection. So in some programs, actually an increasing number of programs, we do what the cardiologists do after they do a heart transplant, which is to biopsy the heart on a routine basis. That's what will happen if I get a heart transplant. I will have heart biopsies on a routine basis to make sure, because otherwise I have no idea whether I'm having a rejection or not. The programs are increasing. My program does it. Protocol biopsies, and we do it on regular intervals, 2 or 3 times during the first year, to make sure that we are not missing any rejections, because we don't want any. Transplant medications, immunosuppressants, are used to prevent rejection. That's really what they are supposed to do. So taking them regularly and for life, your immune system will never like that kidney. Sorry, but it will never learn it. Occasionally you read reports that we all hate, any of us in transplant medicine, we all hate, because you hear the report of that exception, you know, that person that stopped all the medications 5 years ago and it feels wonderful. And it really makes me nervous, because that's a huge exception to the rule. You know, 90% of the people that stop the medication will lose the kidney. It may not happen right away, but they will lose the kidney. So when those news appear in the newspaper, it makes me very nervous. Did I say it makes me very nervous? Yes. You can read it, but don't listen, okay? So what do they do? Essentially what they do is they prevent the immune system from attacking the transplant kidney. And I will elaborate a little bit more in a cartoon that I built on here. They are key. We couldn't do transplantation without these medications. Unless you have an identical twin, we just couldn't do it. Unfortunately, they are not smart. I mentioned that before. They suppress all the functions of the immune system. They don't care if it is a transplant kidney or it is an infection. It just suppresses everything. They definitely have side effects, and they are expensive. I put in my handout several slides of specific transplant medications and the side effects of those. I'm going to skip all those. We can discuss them, of course, but at least you have the information in your handout. But I didn't want to go through those. It was a little bit tedious, I thought. Instead, I wanted to show you this wonderful cartoon I was building here. Okay, this is you, this is the recipient, and these are your cells. And you see they have hairs in there? Those are the blue hairs, because that's you, right? And this is you. That's how you look like. And that's, say, me. I gave you a kidney, and I look completely different. This is a little kidney, okay? But I gave you my little kidney. No, but it looks different, you know? So the first thing that the immune system does, and they say it bumps into any cell of the body. I'm doing that continuously. You are doing that continuously. So the first part of the immune system is the recognition. It's a key part. When that cell bumps into that kidney, ask the question, you know, does this kidney cell look like me? Is it mine or not? You know, it has the capacity to recognize. It needs to recognize. Now, if it decides that no, it is not. You know, it doesn't have blue hairs. This kidney doesn't have blue hairs. It's not mine. So the immune system then decides at that point, okay, it's not mine, I'm going to kill it. I don't care if it's good for you, it is not good for you, it's not mine, I kill it. So what it does, it becomes what we call in immunology activated. You know, that cell that was peacefully just bumping around suddenly becomes really angry. It changes the metabolism, it becomes very active, it changes how it behaves, and one thing that it does is really multiplies. It needs more troops. So that cell becomes activated, step number one, or in this part of the response to that recognition. And then it really multiplies, you know, because it really wants that troop. And those troops go and kill that kidney. So that's how, it doesn't care again if it is a kidney or it is a pneumococcal pneumonia or it is a mosquito bite or, you know, this reaction happens all the time. To anything, an organ, a blood transfusion. Again, I gave you multiple examples. Essentially, this process and the medications that they are developed, the immunosuppressive medications that they are developed, they are targeted to different parts of the process. The goal that we, the holy grail that we are looking for is this step. If somehow I fool your cells into recognizing the kidney as self, then I don't need immunosuppressive medications. This is what you heard as tolerance, i.e. I can give you a kidney, and somehow I fool you. I give you a magic potion, and I fool you. This kidney is yours. And somehow, then, I don't have to worry about this, because your immune system bumps into the kidney and recognizes it. That, unfortunately, is very feasible in mice. It's occasionally feasible in rats. And that doesn't help us very much, to be honest with you, because it's not feasible in people. You know, but that's really what we all hope to get to at some point. You know, block this recognition. Because if we block the recognition, we are fine. Essentially, where we are stuck is modifying different steps after the recognition. So we admit that we cannot block the recognition. We allow you to recognize the kidney because, really, we cannot do anything else. Because we don't have any medications to stop you from doing that. But at least we can modify your response to that. So we are in a transplantation. We are in that unusual situation that this guy, you, are always trying to recognize the kidney and kill it. You know, and just putting a break after you recognize it. That's the reason why immunosuppressive medications are critical all the time. All the rest of your life. Because in the moment I stop this medication, this will go through. You know, you are always ready. You are always at the gates. You know, your immune system, me, anyone. Medications work in different places, and that's the reason why we can combine in different places to modify different things. Like prednisone blocks the inflammation, particularly in there. If we only block there, which is what we had in the past, that would not be particularly effective. As a matter of fact, it doesn't work by itself. It's just not good enough. But if we combine it with this guy that blocks the production of all these little soldiers in here, well, it's good. Because if we don't make, we have angry cells, but they are very few, and we block them from getting into the kidney, that's good. So that's a good strategy. Cyclosporine and prograf go even before that. It allows, you know, some of the differentiation of these cells into angry cells, but not that much, not that well. So they recognize and they change a little bit, but they are not quite, they are limping along. They cannot do very well, which is great. Now the medication that we are working on is in this step. I wish, again, that we had medications to block this step, you know, the recognition. But we are in good shape. And the other part that we are in good shape is, which is fascinating, I put in here a timeline, and those numbers are not necessarily, those are years, and they are not necessarily placed in an organized order. But it's interesting, really, transplantation started in the 60s, and from the 60s to the 1984, we had two drugs, prednisone and Imuran. Again, they blocked the later part, if you remember the previous slide, the later part, so allowed of the recognition, allowed the angry of the cells. They were not particularly effective unless they were effective in particular patients. And for 20 years, 24 years, essentially nothing else moved in transplantation. So we had very few options. The patients had very few options. The doctors had very few options. 1984, a huge event happened, which is the introduction of cyclosporine into transplantation medicine. This is, if you look at the papers, this is what allowed us physicians to do heart transplants and liver transplants and bowel transplants and kidney transplants and all kinds of crazy things. This introduction of that medication. Another huge event happened in 1996. Look at the timeline. You know how it accelerates. And take that at heart. You know, nothing happens for 20 years and suddenly all more lines are showing up in here. Finally, we have a good group of medications, a fantastic group of medications to work on rejection. So this other medication called Celcept appears in 1996, is derived from Imuran. By the genetics of Imuran, they changed the Imuran to Celcept. So Imuran, essentially, except in Europe, in some other countries, is used still Imuran. But essentially, the United States stopped using Imuran, and we're using Celcept. Which is a fantastic medication. Other medications have appeared, rapamycin, that has had less impact. There are several other medications that I did not include in there, which are derived from this one. So those are kind of the parents, if you want, of those medications. So definitely in the last few years, very important advances have been made in these areas. We have more medications, we have more powerful medications, and we have choices. Before, when we had two medications, if the patient had severe side effects for the two medications, I would tell the patient, well, we had two medications, that's A and B, and you had to take both of them. So I had no choices. Now I have choices. You have choices. These choices actually have resulted in cutting down the rejections, you know, from the 60% to the 10%, 15%. It's remarkable. And now we are in the mode of we have such powerful medications that maybe we don't need three. Probably we need two. Some people are trying one, which makes me very nervous. So we are peeling off. So, I mean, these advances are remarkable. The incidence of rejection, as I mentioned, it really is less than half of what it has been in the 90s in the past. Clearly, the issues of side effects, high cost, and toxicity remain. It's variable in between one thing and another. And again, if you are having side effects from one medication, there is the potential of using another medication. At least I can have that to consider. We went through this, and I wanted to touch, just a touch, I promise I will not keep you much longer, about the scarring of the kidney, because this is really the next frontier in transplantation. Rejection was the frontier in transplantation in the past. We had so many rejections, initially 80%, down to 60%, and every single time you had a rejection, boy, we had a kidney that was really affected by a bad event. Rejection is actually becoming much less of an issue. You know, the 10 percentile that I talked about before. The problem is that the success rate for transplantation is 92% on the first year. However, if you look at the number of kidneys working, it continues to slowly decline after the first year. So if I give you a deceased donor kidney, 50% of those kidneys will be working in 10 years. And that's just not good enough. If you are 20 years old, that's just not good enough. If I give you a living donor kidney, it's double that amount. But if you are 20 years old, that's just not good enough. And I hope you keep thinking that we think about that. This is just not good enough. There is something scarring those kidneys. Essentially, that's what it looks like. This is a normal kidney. This is the filter of the kidney. This is the tubules on the kidney. And when those kidneys scar down, that's what they look like. Those tubules, as you see, they are all shriveled up, and instead of that, you have all this scar tissue on the kidney. And we don't know exactly what this process is all about. There is multiple events happening on the kidney causing the scarring of the kidney. There are huge advances on all this area. Clearly, transplantation is the best treatment available for kidney failure. It's a lifelong commitment from everybody. There are clearly possible complications. Keep this in mind. The present is really bright. What you consider when I started transplantation and medicine is amazing, and clearly the future is much brighter yet on transplantation. Thank you, and sorry for going over time.